Okay, all right, thank you, Debbie. Good afternoon, welcome everyone. I'm going to call to order the Senate Committee on Workforce. Today is Wednesday, April 5th, 2017. Today we are going to have some work sessions and then we're going to move into some of the bills we're going to talk about in more detail. So we're going to have the first bill we're going to have a work session on is Senate Bill 398. And I'm going to ask Deborah to summarize the bill, please.
Senate Bill 398 was sponsored by Senator Steiner Hayward and Representative Kenny Geyer. There was a public hearing in this committee on March 8, 2017. The original bill required employers to include notice in employees' pay stubs that the recipient would be entitled to an earned income tax credit under federal tax laws and to provide internet address and telephone number for further information. It requires the Department of Revenue, Bureau of Labor and Industries, and the Employment Department to adopt rules and increase employee awareness of the earned income tax credit. It requires employers to post summaries of administrative rules and requires BOLI to make summaries of rules and, upon request, complete text of rules available to employees to employers without charge. The -3 amendment replaces the bill. It requires the Labor Commissioner to adopt rules requiring employers to provide annual written notice to employees about earned income tax credits, including a website address for the Internal Revenue Service and the Department of Revenue. It specifies the notice to be provided in English and the employee's primary language with the employee's federal form W-2. It requires the Bureau of Labor and Industry to provide notice to employees in state minimum wage posters about earned income tax credit, requires the Employment Department to provide information to unemployment insurance benefit recipients about earned income tax credits. There is a minimal fiscal impact and a minimal revenue impact.
Okay. I'm going to ask for a motion, please.
Chair Taylor, I move to adopt the -3 amendments dated 4-3-17 to Senate Bill 398.
Senator Knope moves to adopt the -3 amendments dated 4-3-17. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, the amendments are adopted. I'm going to ask for the next motion, please.
Chair Taylor, I move Senate Bill 398 as amended to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a three-pass recommendation.
Senator Knope moves Senate Bill 398 as amended to the Oregon Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, I think we're going to go ahead and pass on roll calls. Debbie, I don't think we need to do that. Seeing any objection, the motion passes. And I'd like to assign a carrier. I believe this is Senator Steiner Hayward's bill. I think that she would like to carry that, so let's go ahead and have her do that. And we're going to close the work session on Senate Bill 398. We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 200. I'm going to ask Deborah to summarize the bill, please.
Senate Bill 200 was introduced by the Senate Interim Committee on Education. There was a public hearing on March 6, 2017. This bill expands the eligibility for members of the public employees retirement system to purchase retirement credits to any person who entered or re-entered active service in the uniformed services after January 1, 1950, or who was in active service in uniform services on January 1, 1950. It defines uniform services. It declares an emergency effective on passage. There are no amendments. There's a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
Just can you stop for a moment, please? We're going to stand at ease for a moment. Okay. Yes. Well, we just had an administrative hiccup there, so. Vice Chair Knope, I have the motion, please.
Yeah. All right. Chair Taylor, I move Senate Bill 200 to the Senate President's office with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Knope moves Senate Bill 200 to the Senate President's office with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
What does that motion mean?
Is that for referral to
another committee? For referral to, I think we, for the referral.
Referral to joint some
ways
other.
And means. To joint ways and means.
Oh, to joint ways and means. Okay, mm-hmm. Gotcha.
So I think that we should.
We could just substitute that and then everything else should be the same.
Okay, well, this is a subsequent referral. So we're going to go ahead and do the motion again in order to get the language right on the record, and we'll have a. Chair, I'm going to ask Vice Chair can I hope for the recommendation?
Take another whack at it.
Okay, great.
Chair Taylor, I move Senate Bill 200 to the Senate President's Office with a due pass recommendation and it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Does that sound right?
Subsequent referral, yes.
Subsequent referral.
Senator Knope moves Senate Bill 200 to the Senate President's Office with a subsequent referral to the Joint Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the motion passes. It closes the work session on Senate Bill 200. Now we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 279 and ask Deborah to summarize the bill, please.
Senate Bill 279 was sponsored by Senators Roblin and McEwen. There was a public hearing on March 1st, 2017. The bill requires that employees' notice of non-payment of wages and compensation to the employer includes a clear and unambiguous statement that payment of unpaid wages and compensation within 12 days of receiving notice limits the penalty to the amount of the employee's unpaid wages or compensation. There's a dash one amendment that removes the qualifier that the required statement in the written notice of non-payment must be clear and unambiguous. There's no fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
Okay. I'm going to ask Vice Chair Knope for a motion, please.
Chair Taylor, I move to adopt the dash one amendment stated 32317 to Senate Bill 279.
Senator Knope moves to adopt the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 279, dated 3/23/17. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, amendments are adopted.
Chair Taylor, I move Senate Bill 279 as amended to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Knope moves Senate Bill 279 as amended to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, the motion passes, and they'd like to assign a carrier. And I see that Senator Roblin's here in the room, coincidentally. So we are going to go ahead and assign the bill to Senator Roblin, and we're going to close the work session on Senate Bill 279. And we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 416 and ask Deborah to summarize the bill, please.
Senate Bill 416 was sponsored by Senator Beyer at the request of the Labor Commissioner. There was a public hearing held on March 1st, 2017. This bill clarifies the prevailing wage rate laws in various respects. It prohibits anyone from dividing public works projects into more than one contract to avoid the prevailing wage rate laws. It clarifies the factors for determining if a project has been divided. It clarifies that public works contracts and subcontracts must specify that every contractor and subcontractor, unless exempt, must file a bond with the Construction Contractors Board. It requires a disadvantaged business enterprise, a minority-owned business, a woman-owned business, and a business owned by a service-disabled veteran and an emerging small business to post a bond if it fails to pay workers at the prevailing wage rate. It clarifies actions that violate the provisions prohibiting any person other than the contractor or subcontractor to pay the prevailing wage rate or fringe benefits to workers performing a public works contract. It establishes that failure to pay fringe benefits and failure to pay prevailing wage rates are separate violations and declares an emergency effective on passage. There are no amendments, has a minimal fiscal impact, and no revenue impact.
Okay, I'm going to ask Vice Chair Knope for a motion, please.
Chair Taylor, I move Senate Bill 416 to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Knope moves Senate Bill 416 to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, I'm going to assign Senator Manning, actually, as the carrier to this bill. He worked on this bill as well, and so we are going to have him carry it. And we're going to close the work session on Senate Bill 416 and open a work session on Senate Bill 712. And ask Deborah to summarize the bill, please.
Senate Bill 712 was introduced by the Senate Committee on Workforce. There was a public hearing held on March 20th, 2017. SB 712 modifies the formula for calculating the hours of service credit of the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan members for vesting purposes and retirement credits by including time that the member received workers' compensation disability payments in certain circumstances. It declares an emergency and it's effective on passage. There's a dash three amendment that replaces the bill. It expands eligibility to OPSERT members to accrue retirement credit and hours of service credit during periods of disability leave when the member returns to qualified employment after receiving workers' compensation benefits for an injury or disease sustained while an actual performance of duty and not intentionally self-inflicted. It defines workers' compensation benefits. It limits the application to PERS members who retire on or after the Act's effective date. There is a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
Okay, I'm going to...
And that's the same motion as before.
Mm-hmm. The first one. Yeah. So I'm going to ask Vice Chair Knope for a motion, please.
Chair Taylor, I move to adopt the dash three amendments dated 3917 to Senate Bill 712.
Senator Knope moves to adopt the dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 712, dated 3917. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, the amendments are adopted. And I'm going to ask for the next motion, please, from Senator Knope.
All right, we're going to take a whack at this one.
Okay.
Chair Taylor, I move Senate Bill 712, as amended, to the Senate President's Office with a due pass recommendation for a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Knope moves Senate Bill 712 as amended to the Senate President's Office with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to the Joint Ways and Means Committee. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, the motion passes, and we close the work session on Senate Bill 712. Now, our lovely audience waited through all of that. I apologize for that. Just happened to come on a day when we had several bills that were moving out. So now we are going to have a public hearing on Senate Bill 1040. And I ask Deborah to summarize that bill, please.
Senate Bill 1040 includes chief sponsors of Senators Burdick, Roblin, and Manning, and Representatives Williamson, Lively, and Rayfield. It establishes the policy that private sector labor organizations and employers may enter union security agreements requiring membership in labor organization as a condition of employment to the full extent allowed by federal law. It declares emergency and is effective on passage. There are no amendments at this time.
Okay, so we're going to go ahead and call up Senator Roblin and Representative Lively, please. And then next up, we are going to ask that,
here's this list. It's the same.
Tom Chamberlain, Jen Baker, Jeff Anderson, and Tim Foster will come up next, please. Hello.
Hello. It is very nice to be here in front of such an illustrious committee. And in particular, such a fine chair. So, for the record, my name is Arnie Roblin, and I am the senator from District 5, which is most of the Oregon coast, actually, Coos Bay to Tillamook Bay and into Sheridan and Falls City in the valley. So, I'm here in support of Senate Bill, 1040. Really what I want to tell you is a little story. In my family, we had five kids. My dad was a union carpenter. My uncle worked at the mill, but before that he was a union teamster. My other uncle worked for Seattle City Light. He was an electrician. He was a union electrician. My whole family, and many of them began the issues with the battles that happened in the 30s and 40s around unionization in this country. And from my perspective as a kid growing up in a small town in the 1950s, it was kind of this amazing world where the middle class was growing and burgeoning. And, you know, there, from my perspective and in my family, that was entirely the results of hardworking people who had fought to have the right to have unions in the private sector. And we saw a burgeoning of this whole group of people that came back from the Second World War getting into jobs and making family wage jobs and making a middle class in this country. And from my perspective, now living on the coast where poverty has taken over from those jobs, I wish we could get back into the woods and do the things that I think are important and with all those good union jobs that used to be there. But the reality is our middle class is shrinking. Our people who can actually have a job that pays a family wage is shrinking. And I believe that that is in part due to things that have happened over the years with respect to unionization and having a workforce that feels empowered to do the right things. Dad was also a union apprentice trainer in the carpenter deal, and so I got to see lots of people come through our house and talk to them and understand how craftsmanship is developed and how, you know, if you go all the way back to Europe and look at the way we trained people to do these craft jobs, it was an honorable, great profession. And we need to continue to have those kinds of conversations. What this bill simply does is say, we want to keep the status quo. What's working in Oregon is working. There are union and non-union groups all around, but we have a right in the state for unions to bargain and to work through those agreements with their employers. We have seen an attack on this in other states. There's been court cases. There's also been opportunities for different groups to start thinking about maybe we'll do this by counties or smaller units. And I believe that the state would be better served by having a preemption, the ability for this to happen across the state and not get torn apart one little group at a time. And so I am really concerned about having a strong middle class again in this country. And I think that if you look prior to the unionization efforts in the 20s and 30s and 40s, we had a really difficult time. There was a disparity between the rich and the poor, and we didn't have the protections that those have come. When we got into the 1950s and 60s, when we had fairly strong private unions, we ended up having a much bigger middle class that felt safer and protected. We had workers that worked really hard, understood that how hard they work and what they did made profits for the company. That's great. Everybody that I knew in those days really believed that their job was to make their companies successful, but they wanted to have an equal say in different kinds of things and in those bargained agreements. For me, this bill keeps that status quo, allows those relationships to continue and hopefully, in my opinion, flourish so that we have that middle class reestablished in this country. I would hope at the same time, and I know that there's a number of my union friends that I've talked with, that we would get back into the business of harvesting more of our timber, doing other kinds of things, and using those natural resources in Oregon. But that's a totally separate issue from this one. This one says, let's keep the status quo. Let's not get torn apart county by county or whatever if there's different kinds of things. And let's make sure that people understand that in this state, if you have a union and working with a contract and with people, that it's honored and the state supports that. So I would stand for questions, and but I know there's experts that can talk a lot more about it than I can. But to me, this is one of those foundational issues that I grew up with. You know, I always tell people, it was really weird. I went back after I was college to home, and somebody said, let's go out to this little fast food place. And I said, fast food? I didn't know there was one there. And they said, well, come on, we'll show you. And I got out there, and I thought, oh, I can't do it. Because there was a list on my refrigerator on places that were non-union, and you didn't go to those if I wanted to come home. I mean, I'm telling you, it was a different world. And one in which people had spent a lot of time in their lives working to make a better world for all of us. And, you know, to me, it was that greatest generation coming and giving something forward. So that's why this bill is an emotional one to me. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator Rowland. Does anyone have any questions for Senator Rowland? Okay. Representative Ivey.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to present testimony. My name is John Lively. I'm from House District 12, which is Springfield. I testified before the House Judiciary Committee 2 days ago and forgot to identify myself, and nobody corrected me, so I write it down now that I need to do that just so. And I come at this a little different perspective than Senator Rowland. It was not raised in a family that was unionized, worked in union shops, though my children now do, but that was not my background. I come from a very different perspective. So first, I want to talk a little bit. I'm a strong supporter, as most people know, of local control and letting cities and counties address issues according to local values, which might be different from other parts of the state. This belief dates back to my earliest years in politics when I was on the Springfield City Council and the mayor of the city of Springfield. Many times I contacted my state elected leaders and asked them to butt out of our business. That was something I did a lot of and came up and testified to those effects. However, since serving in the Oregon House since 2013, I have learned that things aren't always as simple as they might seem. Many times each session I have struggled with issues dealing with local versus state jurisdiction and concluded each issue is unique in itself. I now understand that indeed some issues do require consistency across the state, which can only be accomplished through preemption of local governments. Springfield has historically been a working class community with the vast majority of our citizens being middle class. For many years, private sector unions played a critical role in ensuring not only fair pay and benefits for members, but also creating similar opportunities to those who were not members. Today, some of the best paying jobs left in Springfield for working class are those that are in the pulp and paper mill that we have there that are indeed unionized employees. Unfortunately, that is the exception. Springfield, like many other Oregon communities, finds a diminishing middle class as the result of multiple factors that have forever changed our economy. Certainly, a decreasing number of workers represented by unions is one important factor leading to that decline. I worked for many years in economic development, where we were competing with other states for private sector investments, leading to expanded employment opportunities for our citizens. Over that time, many states were changing their laws relating to union security agreements in what I often called was the race to the bottom. At national conferences, they would often tout being the cheapest place to do business as the primary reason that businesses would locate in their states. I never touted Oregon as being the cheapest because we weren't then and we aren't now from a standpoint of labor costs. However, workforce availability, the skills of the workforce, available higher education, our natural environment, the high quality, affordable utilities, all kinds of other issues were the things that I was able to present to businesses that would locate here. And those are the types of things ultimately they made the decisions on, is whether they invested in a state or not. So the fact that we weren't the cheapest necessarily from a labor standpoint was not the deciding factor why businesses would locate here. We should be looking for ways to raise wages, improve standards, and rebuild the middle class, not allowing our state to enter this race to the bottom. This bill is about the simplest policy that can ensure private sector labor relations remain consistent in Oregon to the full extent allowed by federal law, and that keeping the status quo of mishmash of policies where some counties have attacked workers and others from being our reality in Oregon. This is one of those cases where I've discovered that since serving this legislature, where I believe the state is in the best position and is the best prepared to address the issues around private sector labor unions. Local jurisdictions should not be intervening in the private sector labor relations like I am concerned they could be without this bill. I urge your support to Senate Bill 1040. Thank you very much.
Okay. Any questions for Senator Levy? Yes, Senator Hansel.
John, I know that a lot of this concern comes out, I think, of the Sixth Judicial Court and that issue, mm-hmm. and understand why, you know, the union community and would be concerned about that because it ruled that local jurisdictions like the state in the past. But I'm wondering, I believe there are 28 states that are right-to-work states, and I think the trend is kind of moving in that direction. I think there more states are moving in that direction. If it is so detrimental, why are they doing that? Do you have any... I know you don't want Oregon to move in that direction because it'd be detrimental to the middle class. And think, why do we have the majority of states in the United States moving in that direction?
So, Chair and Senator Hansel, so my personal opinion, that's what this will be. I believe the number may be correct, 28. I don't know. It's grown over time. As I worked in economic development, there was more states coming on. So let me just relate a story that I know in some cases has prompted some of this. So one of the conferences I went to, and I won't name the very large U.S. corporation that was putting on this conference. It was a suppliers conference. And one of the things they made very clear in this conference was that they expected their suppliers net to locate in states that were right to work when it have potentially the lowest labor cost. That was what was told in the conference, and in fact, some of the companies I went back there to work with that are not in those states were told they couldn't apply to be things. So I think there's a lot of pressures in the economy for a lot of different reasons. I just don't believe that's the best direction to go. I think if you look at many of those states that have, again, when competing with them, there were sometimes absolutely location, a lot of other things did, and sometimes certainly wage might have made the factor, but we have so much more to offer in this state. You know, natural abilities and a whole bunch of things, location on the West Coast, that from my standpoint, it just doesn't make sense that we would take that step too.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. So we'll go ahead and call up Tom Chamberlain, Jeff Anderson. And is Jen Baker here?
She does Chris not. Hewitt.
Yeah. Okay. Then we'll have Chris Hewitt come up. Perfect. Are you Tim Foster? Okay, you can. We'll maybe have you in the next round. Okay. Or do you want to? You can pull up a chair if you want, or do the next round, or whichever you like.
Can I just sit right there?
Sure, of course. Okay, who wants to go first?
I'll go first, if it's all right. Chair Taylor, members of the committee, my name is Tom Chamberlain. It is my honor to be representing today the 300,000 working men and women of the Oregon AFL-CIO. The Oregon AFL-CIO has a history of long history of advocating for all workers in the legislative process, a watchdog for any efforts to undermine workers' rights in the state of Oregon. You've heard from Senator Roblin, Representative Lively, a bit about Senate Bill 1040, the Rural Oregon Worker Protection Act, and why it is needed. I'd like to give you a bit more background and rationale for why this simple, straightforward bill is needed. The National Labor Relations Act was passed in 1935. It set a framework for private sector labor relations across the country. Since that time, the bill has only been amended twice. In the late 40s, Taft-Hartley was passed, which allows states to pass legislation that would allow states to regulate certain components of the act. Unfortunately, with workers and their unions being under attack from many different angles, a recent development out of the Sixth Circuit Court leaves us concerned about a major disruption in private sector labor relations, and without this bill, where local jurisdictions could, for the first time, attack workers and their unions in the private sector. As you can see, this bill ensures the status quo of private sector labor relations that we've had for the last 80 years and ensures that employers and workers can continue to enter in union security agreements, which ensures fairness, consistency, and representation costs. This is minor but an important clarification to ensure these important relationships between the employer and the labor organization can continue like they've had for many years. You'll hear today from private sector union leaders and employers about why this simple, basic clarification in the law is so needed. Thank you for your time, and thank you for allowing me to speak in front of you today.
Okay. Mr. Anderson.
Chair Taylor, Vice Chair Canope. My name is Jeff Anderson. I am Secretary Treasurer of the United Food and Commercial Workers, Local 555. We are the largest private sector local union in the state of Oregon, with members in Southwest Washington. Our local is made up of over 25,000 workers who work in a diverse set of industries, including retail, healthcare, bootmakers, and a number of poultry, beef, and seafood processing, among others. Our union is growing with the recent addition of 4,000 newly organized workers, many from rural communities. Our members live in 32 of the 36 counties of our state. Local 555 supports Senate Bill 1040 as a much needed and simple law that assures management and labor have a continued orderly process of labor relations in the private sector. I grew up in rural Oregon. Today, where the lumber mill and forklift plant stood are empty buildings and lost jobs. My hometown of Dallas, Oregon, once boasted 1,400 family-wage jobs from these two sites. Rural Oregon has seen their standard of living decline in correlation to the decline of union jobs in the wood products industry. Many counties have suffered high unemployment and limited opportunity. Today, 555 members in those communities have fair wages, pensions, and family health insurance. UFCW 555 is a union addressing the needs of our members and benefiting our communities in part through collective bargaining, with some contracts dating back into the early 1900s. A typical local 555 collective bargaining agreement may cover members in multiple counties, such as some ranging from entire regions of the state. We have been able to maintain consistent representation of our members across county lines, in part due to the statewide and national framework set out by the National Labor Relations Act. Due to the court case you've heard about, if a local jurisdiction were to attack workers and their unions by attacking union security agreements, it would create a major imbalance for both the union and employer to manage with different rules. Union security agreements do one thing. They ensure a fair and consistent cost sharing of representation. It's good for workers and it's good for employers. Senate Bill 1040 is a minor but vitally important bill needed to ensure that the status quo of the past 80 years is maintained in private sector labor relations as it relates to union security agreements. We respectfully request the committee to pass Senate Bill 1040. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Taylor, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chris Hewitt. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association. And I also want to thank you for the opportunity to testify in strong support of Senate Bill 1040. ONA represents nearly 15,000 nurses throughout our state, providing care in almost every setting in the industry that's imaginable. Staff nurses in large and small hospitals, school-based health centers, and local public health departments serving our communities. And over two-thirds of ONA's members do work in the private sector today. And in Oregon, nurses have had a long history in leading the nation with regard to nursing practice and standards for registered nurses and advanced practice nurses alike. And so for over a century, ONA members have exercised their collective voice to help improve working conditions for all nurses and to promote the very best health care for patients across our state. However, nurses, too, are not immune from the deliberate attacks that I think have been mentioned here that aim to weaken the shared voice and limit the ability to advocate for safe patient care. So-called right-to-work laws have continually resulted in adverse consequences for our workforce and in other areas of the country. From reducing median wages and eroding baseline industry safety standards to heightening things like infant mortality rates and decreasing access to employer-provided health care, these are the types of policies that remain a danger for working families and patients. So at ONA, we're really concerned, I think, more broadly about the increasingly prevalent anti-worker strategies we're witnessing being orchestrated around the country to undermine our unions. And we believe strongly that the nursing sector today is more fair and worker-centered as a result of robust collective bargaining rights. So enabling a patchwork of disparate regional attacks on labor organizations, we think is likely to induce nurses to actually leave certain areas where those might come into play to seek work in places where standards are higher and where they will have a stronger voice on the job. This would stand as an impediment to our healthcare system in a time when many rural areas are already struggling with access to a qualified provider workforce for their care. We think Oregon should set the floor as it relates to standards. Local communities should be encouraged to strengthen protections, not weaken them. And SB 1040 is an important and common sense opportunity to help ensure both workers and their employers can maintain consistency at the state level in terms of negotiating union security agreements. So with that, ONA urges your support for SB 1040. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Hello. Chair Taylor and committee members. My name is Tim Foster. I'm the Assistant Business Manager of the IBW Local 48. I'm also representing the Oregon Building and Construction Trades Council. Thank you for your opportunity to speak with you in support of SB 1040, the Rural Workers Protection Act, and its importance to the building trades workers. The building and construction trades, with approximately 25,000 workers in 21 unions and 6 regional councils in Oregon, do construction work in literally every corner of the state of Oregon. The nature of our work is temporary, meaning that when I, as an electrician, show up on a job, I'm working myself out of that job. meaning that I could be working in Eugene 1 week, Astoria the next week, and the Dalles the week after that. The historically good relationship we've had with our contractors and their related associations through the years is critical to the efficiency and effectiveness of our workforce, a workforce that is developed and trained at our world-class training facilities that are jointly and privately funded through our unique labor management trusts. The efficient and effective workforce is what drives the construction industry in Oregon. Anything that cuts into this relationship, such as potential for a local anti-union, anti-middle-class, so-called right-to-work laws, is just bad for business. A big reason for our ability to attract new craftsmen and women into the trade is because of the statewide continuity of labor relations and the strength and success of our apprenticeship programs. When potential apprentices look at their options for joining a craft, they can look across Oregon and see the standards are the same everywhere. There are no counties that are enacting harmful legislation for workers. There are no cities that are actively attacking workers and their unions. This reality gives an apprentice the confidence that their career choice is a sound one, and if they put in the work, time, and commitment to their craft, this choice provides a pathway to support their families, contribute to their communities, and do meaningful work that leaves a lasting impact. Due to the recent court case you've heard about, And without this bill, new apprentices could face a very different reality than what I faced when I entered the craft 29 years ago. This bill is a simple way to ensure that new apprentices entering the field can have the assurances that a construction craft is a solid bet on their future, even with the ebbs and flows of the industry the way it is. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on SB 1040 today.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to go ahead and call up Ben Strako, please. Is he here? And then after that, we will have Maurice Ramming and John Killen. Hello.
Hi. For the record, my name is Ben Straka.
Welcome.
And what's that?
I said welcome.
Thank you. Policy analyst at the Freedom Foundation.
And are you located here in Portland or
here in Salem?
Here in Salem, excuse me. Okay, great.
Yes.
Thank you.
Chair Taylor and members of the Senate Committee on Workforce, thank you for the opportunity to testify. On behalf of the Freedom Foundation, I respectfully urge you to oppose Senate Bill 1040. SB 1040 would expressly prohibit local governments from passing local right-to-work protections for private sector employees. Under the National Labor Relations Act, the authority to enact right-to-work is reserved to the states and their political subdivisions. However, SB 1040 would preempt the ability of local jurisdictions to make their own decisions about right-to-work. Right-to-work laws simply provide that employees cannot be required to pay dues or fees to a labor union as a condition of employment. In other words, employees benefiting from right-to-work protections cannot be fired simply because they choose not to join or financially support a union. Most employees have never had a say in whether they are represented by a union, and many disagree with their union's objectives, tactics, or political agendas. Fundamentally, being forced to financially support the activities of a private labor organization represents an infringement upon an employee's First Amendment right to freedom of speech and association. Aside from protecting an employee's associational freedoms, right-to-work laws do not affect collective bargaining in any other way. Nothing prevents unions from representing employees as they do now and bargaining as they do now, and nothing prevents employees from joining a union and paying dues voluntarily. In fact, some reports actually suggest that unions in right-to-work states have experienced greater membership gains than those in non-right-to-work states, possibly because unions in right-to-work states must be especially attentive to workers' needs in order to earn their financial support. Given the undeniable burdens that compulsory union fees place on employee freedom, it is alarming that SB 1040 seeks to create a statewide policy cementing such compulsion and preventing local governments from having any say in that matter. Right-to-work laws have also been shown to have positive economic effects. In Kentucky's Warren County, the first county to pass a local right-to-work law, the Chamber of Commerce reported that business investment and new job creation within the county reached record highs following its 2015 right-to-work ordinance. The Warren County attorney, a Democrat, further substantiated those claims of economic improvement by reporting that multiple business development prospects contacted the county, citing the right-to-work ordinance as the reason for their interest. Just as Warren County and several others experimented with right-to-work and found it to be economically beneficial to their communities, so too might local jurisdictions within our state. Generally speaking, Oregon law allows counties and cities to exercise a broad range of authority over local affairs, and for good reason. Local governments are better suited to address the particular needs of their constituents, and they likely have a better understanding of the economic and social conditions of their communities. So why shouldn't the state's diverse collection of 36 counties and more than 200 cities be able to decide this issue for themselves? SB 1040 is a broad preemptive policy that sacrifices the principle of local control to ensure that local governments cannot enact right to work. In doing so, it does not account for the various needs of Oregon's local communities, nor respect the valid reasons that local jurisdictions may have for exercising the authority currently given to them by the NLRA. The Freedom Foundation supports both the concept of right to work and the right of local governments to decide for themselves whether to allow union security agreements between employers and unions within their jurisdictions. So on behalf of the Freedom Foundation, I respectfully urge the committee to oppose 1040. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Do you have a question?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Is Tim McCabe your CEO?
Tom, yes.
Tom,
yes.
Yeah. He's been quoted as saying, we want to fight unions because unions have corrupted our states, and they've ensured that we are the bluest state. And is this really your guiding principle for your organization, to fight and undermine unions?
Chair, I'll address it to you, and sorry for not going through you earlier. But, Chair, thank you for the question, Senator. Well, I think that the sentiment Tom's expressing is the fact that given the compulsory nature of these fees, it is disproportionate or as opposed to voluntary fees. I mean, that's going to create a disproportionate effect on the state when it comes to policies and establish what, I think is undeniably a pretty big special interest in the state, being the labor unions. So I think that's his point that he's making. Is
just a follow-up.
My
area, I come from the Gresham area, and it has some of the densest poverty in the state per capita. Mm-hmm. And minimum wage just doesn't cut it, and we have extreme poverty. And what I'm worried about is you say you support freedom and employee choice, but I'm very concerned about the undermining of the unions. And could you maybe just explain a little bit about the ultimate objectives of your organization, giving some of the troubling things that I've seen on your website?
Sure. Chair Taylor, Senator, thank you for the question. I think I can sort of make the connection again when, at the most fundamental level, it has to do, we feel, with freedom of association. That turns into political speech, but when that political speech that is funded, as is currently the case in most cases, through fees that employees have no choice but to pay, that in turn creates a political system and, kind of a union grip on maybe state politics that so the one leads to the other.
That's fine. I'm a nurse and a strong union member. Maybe you know that now, but it has really helped my profession, and it has really helped me when I was a single mom, helped me provide a very nice life for my kids.
Right. Chair Taylor, may I respond?
Yes, you may.
Senator, I just want to clarify, I'm a little bit mystified, honestly, by the constant characterization of right to work as anti-worker, anti-union, because because it's easy to kind of throw those labels on it, but when you get into the practical policy effects, which I would encourage you all to look at, is really it does not change the union's ability to bargain. It can, if it's offering good service, it doesn't stop members from signing up and paying dues. And so the only thing it really changes is what the Supreme Court over and over again has said is a pretty burdensome infringement upon freedom of association. It's kind of an anomaly that you can force folks to pay for something that they don't want to be associated with at all. But in the end, they can still sign up members, they can still bargain for their employees. So.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Follow-up. Senator Hansel, but before that, ladies and gentlemen, I appreciate everyone coming here today. We do try to maintain a level of decorum here in the Capitol, and he is a resident here of Salem, and he is here to testify, and he has the right to do that. So I just ask that people be respectful when someone's giving their testimony, please. Senator Hansel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll ask you the same question that I asked Representative Hovley. The trend seems to be moving to right-to-work states. Why do you think that is happening? What is, on the national level, from your opinion, taking place?
Well, look, I think, Senator, thank you for the question. I think that workplaces have shifted, just the nature of workplaces throughout the country. I think we can't deny that. I think as well, and I'll kind of counter that with saying, again, we heard a lot about this keeps the status quo, and that's very important. I think that's an important point that you make, that the status quo can't be attributed all to what are deemed attacks on workers. Nevertheless, we've consistently seen declines in union membership. So I just think that the labor model as it currently exists in non-right-to-work states is not as compatible as maybe it once was, as we heard Senator Roblin saying maybe back in the 20s, 30s, in that era. So I think it has dramatically shifted.
Okay. Senator Gelser.
Thank you. I had two questions.
Is yes, okay? Of course. Yes, please.
Okay. The first question is, do members have rights to services as members? Rights to services as members of a union, like representation?
Chair, Senator, yes, the union has a duty of fair representation.
And how would that be offered to individual workers if they did not have that protection of the union?
Chair, Senator, under right to work, because it's only limited authority under the NLRA and it affects only private sector employees, I believe the only protection that can be offered is that, and it's kind of telling that that is the only protection that was put into the NLRA, was that of states being able to prohibit compulsory union fees. So under right to work, the union still has a duty to represent those in its bargaining unit, regardless of whether or not they pay. Now, on a side note, for example, state law can govern public sector employment or labor relations, and there are options then for saying that, well, if you join and pay, you can be represented, but the union's not obligated. But I believe under the NLRA, that's not the case.
And a different question altogether.
Follow up.
I've been trying to track down this article. I read it a couple of years ago while I was visiting my parents in Nevada, but they changed the law. What happened was there was an organization that was the there was an organization, an organization similar to yours in Nevada that entered into a mailing and a poll to all teachers in the Clark County School District, which is in Las Vegas, urging them to withdraw their benefits, leading with, you can save $750 if you do this by this date. And the goal of that was to drop the union membership below 50%. Later that year, when I was there, there was an enormous conflict within the district, I believe, for the classified union, because that membership had dropped below 50%, and there was an argument about who had the ability to negotiate for those workers. So the workers, when it was time to renew the contract, people came in and argued that nobody could advocate for them. So if something like that happened, what is it that keeps that moving forward? And would your organization plan to aggressively pursue members in an effort to break those unions and drop them below 50%?
Chair, Senator, thanks. There's lots of parts to that question. I'd be curious to know, first of all, again, I think I heard you correctly, but this was school districts. So in public employment, if, you know, from the Freedom Foundation's policy, from my standpoint, if we were to effect some kind of change at the statewide level over public employment, I would certainly advocate for a modified right to work situation in which, like I said, employees can join and pay dues and be represented, but employees who do not wish to associate at all not only don't have to pay against their will, but they don't have to. The union is not obligated to represent them without that cost. So that answers the question of what we might advocate for here. Could you restate? It was a long question.
I guess so let's say that this bill passes. Mm-hmm. Would your organization plan to kind of follow in the footsteps of the Nevada Policy Research Institute, which forwarded this proposal in Nevada, and aggressively pursue union members to urge them to opt out of their union in order to break the union?
Chair, Senator, I don't think that members can entirely opt out unless the state is already a right-to-work state statewide. I know there are constitutional protections for the portion in a non-right-to-work state, the portion of union dues that one must pay to their union that are explicitly used for political, ideological expenditures, that sort of thing. So I do know a lot about employees opting out of that portion. I think that's jumping the gun to say that, while Oregon is not a right-to-work state, we simply can't, and I don't think we would, try to get employees to opt out of everything because that's impossible. Furthermore, I would be curious to know, it's a little bit hard to believe that if employees in Nevada are opting out of all of that so much, it seems reasonable to me that maybe they are those who don't want the representation either. If they don't want to pay so bad, they likely don't want to associate with the union whatsoever. So I would, again, in Nevada, probably recommend that situation, which they could have done, in which members join, pay, or represented, and non-members don't have to pay, and the union doesn't have to represent them.
And one final follow-up.
Yes.
Thank you. And has your organization at any point visited home care workers and urged them to drop their union membership?
Chair, Senator, we do outreach to home care workers. We don't urge them to. We're very polite. We let them know their rights, their constitutional rights, because what we found starting out and also with some of the reactions from the unions now is that there is a concerted effort to prevent them from knowing these rights, and many choose to stay in the union and keep their money, and some choose to opt out. And again, that's that burdensome, that high standard of freedom of association that the Supreme Court has consistently upheld. We just feel it's important that they know that that right even exists, which most of them do not even know that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Do we have any other questions? Okay. Thank you for coming and testifying. We are now going to call up Maurice Ramin and John Killen, please. Gentlemen, hello.
Hello. Good afternoon. I'll go first, I guess. Chair Taylor, members of the committee, and for the record, my name is John Killen. I am the executive director of the Associated Wall and Ceiling Contractors of Oregon. While affiliated with a number of trade groups and alliances, my members are primarily a dozen large construction contractors who design and install a wide variety of mostly commercial wall and ceiling systems like what you see around here. In combined total, they employ approximately 2,500 employees for more than $200 million in payroll and benefits, and total revenues and expenses of over $300 million per year. Over the last decade, margins for these contractors have averaged below 2%. I'm here today in support of this bill. I've come to learn that when employers and workers come together as industry partners, it is indeed a better outcome. I have also learned that being a union member or being signatory to a union is about choice for both the individual and the employer. I've seen this industry from both sides. I've worked for the union groups, I've worked for the non-union groups, and I've found that there are advantages to working with the highly trained, highly skilled workforce of the union construction trades. This partnership provides our contractors the ability to deliver highly technical, quality products on time and on budget with predictability. Our member contractors build projects in every corner of the state and in every county, and I can tell you that predictability and consistency is essential to running their businesses. There's one thing that pretty much every business person could and would tell you. Having a mishmash, quilt, or patchwork of different laws and codes from city to city is not just challenging, it's virtually impossible to deal with. In the case of a patchwork of right-to-work laws, a signatory contractor would be left in a legal mess with opposing commitments to their employees. This is similar to why we have statewide building codes, statewide safety regulations, statewide unemployment insurance, and statewide payroll taxes. And frankly, this is why we would like even more consistency from one jurisdiction to another, not less. This bill would help provide a commitment of consistency for signatory employers throughout the state with no direct effect on non-union employers or local government. On behalf of the Associated Wall and Ceiling Contractors, we ask that you forward this bill with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, thank you. Hello.
Hello. Excuse me. Chair Taylor and commissioners, committee members, I apologize because I'm not used to publicly speaking like this.
I'm right there with you. I don't like doing it either, believe it or not. So welcome.
Okay. My company is O'Neill Electric, O'Neill Construction Group in Howard Jacobs Masonry. My name is Maurice Ramin. We were founded in 1998, and we're a signatory firm. We're signatory with both the painters, the IBEW, carpenter operators, and so on. There's a huge value in being a signatory carpenter or signatory contractor. One of the things that we look at is our relationship with the unions and how they provide high quality employees. These are professionals. This is a profession, and what they do is they provide the training necessary through through the apprenticeship program so that the jobs are safe, the employees are safe, and at the end of the day, the tenants in the buildings are safe. That safety costs money, and there's no cost to the taxpayer. This is a collaborative effort between both the unions and the contractors themselves. So we end up with, you know, and for me, this is the best business approach because you have a strengthened apprenticeship program. You have high quality work being done out there. It's a collaboration, not a unilateral decision. And the overall outcomes for the projects are much better. One of the things that I could say is that I worked in a right-to-work state in the past. As a worker, what I realized, in my opinion, is that there was a less emphasis on safety. There was a vast variety of skill sets. Some knew what they were doing. Some had no idea it was their first time. There was not a consistency, and as a contractor, we look for consistency. There's not a consistency on the product. So we value that here in Oregon, that we're able to provide that consistency, that high quality. That's one of the founding principles of my company. That's one of the reasons why I started this company here rather than starting it in a right-to-work state. That drew us here. And so I'm highly supportive of this measure, 1040, and I'm hoping that it goes through, and I'm willing to take any questions.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Okay, thank you, gentlemen. Yep. Appreciate it. All right, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1040. Before we move on to the next hearing, I want to thank everybody for coming today to hear about that bill. It's an important bill that we're considering. We're going to move on now to Senate Bill 294 and open a public hearing and ask Deborah to summarize the bill, please.
SB 294 was introduced by the Senate Interim Committee on Workforce. This committee held a public hearing on March 8, 2017. The original bill permits employee of state agencies or representatives of state employees' bargaining units to seek judicial review of a contracting agency's cost analysis in certain circumstances. It establishes jurisdiction of judicial review. It requires a contracting agency to halt procurement while under review, except when a compelling interest or emergency is expressed in writing and supported by substantial evidence. It prohibits the award of costs or attorney's fees and provides additional steps to the procurement process. The Dash 3 amendments replace the bill, narrows the scope of applicability to school districts and education service districts. It replaces the judicial writ of review process with a labor arbitration process. It removes the provision requiring inclusion of reasonably foreseeable fluctuations in miscellaneous costs and estimated contractor profit and cost analysis. It removes the provision prohibiting proceeds from selling or replacing long-term assets in cost analysis. There's no revenue impact, and a fiscal impact statement has been issued.
Okay, and what is the fiscal impact?
It was inexact, depending on the number of arbitrations, and I think it estimated 10 to 14,000 per
okay.
arbitration, roughly.
Okay, I was just curious to know. Okay, here we go. Most of the room's gone. I know it doesn't make you feel very, you know, popular, does it? But here we are. Well, generally, my personal rule of thumb is I usually bring the proponents up first. However, in this case, I'm going to bring up the opponents to the bill. Since we already had the first hearing and we did it the other way, I thought what would be fair is to do it the opposite for this one. So we're going to bring up Lori with OSPA, Spencer Davenport, and Angie Peterman, please. Hello. So before you start, I know that we've had this bill before the committee before, and I don't want to put Senator Knope on the spot here, but how many times has this concept come forward? Maybe two, three?
What?
Several. Okay. Yeah. Several times this concept's come before the committee, okay, in past legislative sessions. And we had the hearing once, and I have to say both sides have been, I think, we've been working together. I've sent them off and said, have some conversations and see if some sort of an agreement can be made. And when you give your testimony today, if you could kind of share about if you're it sounds like you're still opposed to the bill But if there's anything, if it's just the entire bill, if there's certain things that you're specifically against, obviously whatever you decide. But we just want to get a general sense of what it is, because it just keeps coming before the committee. And so we want to understand if it's just a fundamental difference. And so it's Senator Hansel.
Madam Chair, was not this also the hearing that we had the fire alarm right in the middle?
Yes, and that is the, thank you, Senator Hansel. I appreciate that. That's the other reason why we're doing this again, is that I felt that the hearing for this particular bill was a little imbalanced, and that we didn't, both sides did not have necessarily the opportunity, especially those who were perhaps opposed to it. So we're trying to right the ship there on that, and give everyone, we want to be fair in hearing everyone's testimony. So I'm not sure who wants to start. But.
Chair Taylor, Lori Satinspiel, okay, for the Oregon School Boards Association, here in opposition today to Senate Bill 294 and the Dash 3s. Okay. I want to go a little out of order because I've got someone who traveled over 100 miles, and I want to be sure that he gets a chance to speak on the record, and I'll just clean up to try to save time if we have anything we've missed in our testimony. Does
okay.
that work for you?
That's fine.
All right. Very good. For the record, my name is Spencer Davenport, and I am the Chief Financial Officer for Central Point School District 6, located down in beautiful Southern Oregon, and mm-hmm. it is a little more than 100 miles, more like 200 miles. It's going to be about a seven-hour trip. So, but hey, I wanted to be here. This is important, so thank you for allowing me to speak. I wanted to kind of just give a brief introduction about our district, Central Point School District. We serve the suburban area of Central Point, Oregon. We serve the rural communities of Gold Hill and Sam's Valley and the surrounding area in the county. We currently serve about 4,500 students, approximately, well, it's actually 10 schools, and we employ 600 staff members. So I wanted to give you a brief background with regards to Central Point's involvement with contracting out for transportation services. We contracted out back in 2010 and 11, and as you probably remember, that was a pretty brutal time in the state of Oregon. We were reeling from the Great Recession. A lot of difficult decisions were having to be made. In Central Point, the decision to contract out for transportation was one of many very difficult decisions. We had cut over 17 school days during that time. We were actually operating on a four-day school week. We had cut things like elementary music, middle school sports, all field trips unless they were fundraised. We had a staff freeze, hiring freeze, so obviously our class size went up due to attrition. And those were just some of the really difficult decisions that were made. And that brings me to contracting out for transportation services. So again, very difficult decision to be made. There was a court case that came out of this. You're probably familiar with that. It went all the way to the Oregon Supreme Court and ultimately was settled. So where are we now? Well, I'm happy to report to you that Central Point School District is doing very well with our contracted services. Our savings, I'm proud to report, is over $2.2 million during the 5 years since we have contracted out. That's over $450,000 averaged per year in savings, okay? To put that in 2016-17 numbers, that's approximately 26 teachers, full-time teachers, that's approximately 13 school days. As you probably are aware, Oregon has one of the lowest school calendars in the nation. So cutting school days is a very difficult choice as a school district. So I've talked about savings, probably asking, well, what about service? Well, again, I'm happy to report to you that we're very happy with our service provider, First Student. And in fact, the overall feeling is that transportation services have actually improved. How do I say that? We've had less complaints by staff, students, and community members. Okay. Examples of some other benefits that we've seen, because of the size of the private enterprise that we've contracted with, First Student, one example that comes to mind, we had an emergency situation with some students that were up here in the north part of the state, approximately 4 hours away, and they needed to get back to Central Point quickly. First Student, because they have a large network of fleets across the state, were able to swap buses, swap drivers, and get those kids back to Central Point much quicker than we ever would have been able to do with our own in-house service. Okay, that's just a brief example. Arguments and counterclaims that I've heard throughout the years and that outsourcing is just more, frankly, is more expensive. That's not what we're seeing in Central Point. The other argument that we're hearing is that service declines. Again, we are not seeing that. We've been with First Student for 5 years now. Another common argument that I hear is that there's
quote-unquote social implications for outsourcing in the community, and that's that the money that is saved isn't reinvested in the community, and it's virtually sucked out to the profits of the corporation or the larger private entity. That's not the case. We've reinvested that money, that $2.2 million, into added teaching positions, added days, and added programs. We've added field trips back. We've added middle school sports back. We've also added some of our elementary music back. More specifically, $565,000 in sales for the bus fleet, our aged bus fleet. That specifically went right back into our district facilities and was used for other capital improvements, including flooring, roofing, and even some security systems at our high school. So why am I here? As Lori pointed out, I've driven a long ways. This is really important to me. I am a member of that community, and it's a 7-hour round trip today. It is budget season, as you probably know. I'm the chief budget officer for our district, so I should be there working on my budget. Frankly, the law regarding contracting out as written now and the amendments that are proposed, they really do a disservice to students. You're really just forcing our hand as a school district to invest in things that can be done more efficiently and for less cost by experts in the field. I'm curious as well that if this law and the amendments are so critical to the state and it's truly about saving our precious resources, why were other public entities such as cities and counties specifically excluded from the law, either wholeheartedly or partially? Frankly, I come to you today, this is not about saving precious resources. It's not about protecting the public's money or the quote-unquote social implications. Rather, this is an example of public employee union protectionism. And the piece of this and the price of this protectionism is placed on the backs of our students via less teachers, less school days, and less programs. We've experienced it. We've seen it. We're living it. We're in the trenches. We must all prioritize our finances. The laws and amendments governing education should put students first, period. And this law and the proposed amendments do not do that. They put the public employee unions and their memberships first. And I'm sorry for that. Again, thank you very much for your time and for allowing me to speak here today.
Can I ask a question, please? So you've had the contract for 5 years, you said?
For 5 years, yes.
Okay, and have you always had your role? Were you in that role 5 years ago as well? Or
actually, I came on the scene right the first year of the contract.
Okay, but are you familiar with the budget prior to 5 years ago?
Yes, yes.
Okay, and so are you able to speak to what the drivers, or do you know how much the drivers make in the contract when you contract out with First Student? Do you have a
currently?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what their salary, what their wages?
We wouldn't necessarily know what their specific salary is. No, we wouldn't know that in the current contract. Mm-hmm. But I know that they do have to meet all the obligations under minimum wage law, and I know that they have met those because they have come to us and said, hey, we need to bump up wages. And we have done that even outside of the contract. We didn't have to go there. We did that because they needed to give their drivers a bump up in order to meet the market. And so we met them there.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Chair Taylor, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Angie Peterman, Executive Director for the Oregon Association of School Business Officials. I just want to touch on the Dash 3 amendments.
Mm-hmm. Welcome back. I remember you were here before, but yes.
Uh-huh. First of all, I'm, confused and a bit concerned that the Dash 3 amendments basically are taking this language and recommending that it move out of ORS 279, which is the public contracting and procurement, and into Chapter 342, which has to do with teachers and other school personnel. Not sure why, and I guess I'm confused, as I said, why would we move public contracting law out of 279 and make changes within 342 that has nothing to do with public contracting? But in addition to that, as I've looked at the Dash 3 amendments and appreciate very much the work that was done to mitigate some of our earlier concerns, I still have grave concerns with regard to the bill. I mentioned last time I was here
that the language simply changing one word from solely to primarily, in effect, will create a situation where we will be prohibited from doing any contracting out. And if the goal is to prohibit us from contracting out, then the bill should simply state that we're being prohibited from contracting out. The recommendations in this bill to do an RFI, seek quotes, those kinds of things are certainly things that I had suggested, maybe tools that we could use. Building it specifically into this legislation, I'm not sure is advantageous. It will be costly. Arbitration costs, generally $12,000 to $16,000 per arbitration, based on the experience that we have, assuming you're looking at 1 or 2 days in that process, can take 3, 6, or more months in order to get through that process as we go through trying to select and mutually agree to an arbitrator and so forth. As Spencer touched on, you know, if this is great public policy and the appropriate way to go, why would you carve out K-12 ESDs? Why is this not appropriate also to all other contracting entities and agencies out there? You know, the other part of this is that Spencer talked about the savings to his district and reinvestment. There's also savings to the state and this process, if you will, and it's not savings that the state would see dollars back into the state's coffers necessarily, but it's a reduction in transportation and the reimbursement portion of transportation costs that the state bears through the formula, which then leaves more dollars, if you will, to distribute in the remainder of the formula outside of transportation. So
I just want to follow up on that. I mean, when in the formula, the state pays 70% of the transportation costs, and so the districts are keeping any kind of savings. It's not as if the state is.
If our cost overall goes down, so
which
if my cost
doesn't probably happen,
transportation costs.
Right, but we don't receive the money.
Let me clarify. I was not suggesting the state seize the money, but if I reduce my cost from $100 to $90 in transportation, the state's obligation at either 70, 80, or 90% mm-hmm. drops from $700, if you will, mm-hmm. at $100 or $70, excuse me, to $63. That $7 differential stays in the formula but gets distributed out through the formula in a different manner to all districts.
But I think hypothetically it doesn't actually play out that way because the money is absorbed through, you end up using the money for, you need all of the money to pay for your transportation, correct, that the state gives you? It probably doesn't cover the whole.
It's funny that you brought that up because that was one of the areas.
Yeah, well, I don't know that we need to go down that hole, sure. But we'll let that rest for right now, but because okay. I think it's also going to vary per district. The math on that is going to vary, and I think you would agree with that. It's going to vary per district.
That's true.
Yes.
But if you look at the formula and how it works, there's a chunk of money that's separated out of the formula for transportation costs only.
Yeah.
If total transportation costs in the state decrease, the total necessary to set aside for transportation will decrease.
Right.
That's the only point I was trying to make.
Okay. All right. So anything else you wanted to add?
Go ahead, Lori.
Chair Taylor, Lori Satinspiel again for the Oregon School Boards. Just to pull it all together, local control, local decision. Like I tried to talk about each individual legislator up here in your district and how each one of your school districts treat your transportation. It's mixed delivery. And Senator Gelser, Senator Canope, Ben is your largest person in your entity in your district, has a way to use retirees and incentivize health insurance. And so they have some drivers and do that in-house. Senator Hansel, Athena Weston has found a way, this small school district, to keep transportation in-house. It works for them. Their transportation director does some coaching. So when the bus goes out, they have a way to make it work. And I think the key piece is the transportation director and how it works for each individual district. Senator Mont Sanderson, as you know, your largest one is already contracted out. So, and Senator Chair Taylor, yours is mixed as well. So that's, we'd be happy to answer any more questions. Again, we're still going to be opposed to this policy.
Okay. Yes, Senator Hanson.
Spencer, would you be able to supply the statistics that you, I don't know if it's on OLIS or not, but I would like to see
my analysis.
The analysis of your program at Central Point.
I certainly would. Thanks. Yes.
All right. Okay. Thank you.
One last.
Okay.
Chair. I just wanted to point out, dawned on me as we were closing today, I've heard a lot of testimony on other bills today. Right before I left the school district office, I ran into our payroll office, and there was a first student worker in there talking to our payroll clerk, who were friends from prior to when they contracted out. That worker, after 5 years, he was with us, I think, for over 20 years, and now he's still with First Student to this day and still working for them. So I thought that was kind of interesting that that happened today, right before I left, to show that he's still employed, and he's still there, and he's working in the same job that he was when he was with the school district. So I thought that was interesting. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, we're going to go ahead and call up. Tyler, we heard from before, but you can come up. And Sarah Drescher, and then who is Stephanie Hicks with? Okay. And also Jared Mason with OEA, if you want to come up. So we have to be mindful of time here. So who wants to talk about what's changed in the bill from what we originally had to where we're at now, and then who would like to do that?
I can speak to that real quick.
Okay.
Yeah. So Chair Taylor, members of the committee, my name is Todd Shipman. I'm with the Oregon School Employees Association. Mm-hmm. Just real quick to address some of the changes. For starters, the process has been changed from a writ of review court process to an arbitration process. And that was done because arbitration processes can be completed quickly and without appeal. Arbitration is already used in school settings for dispute resolution between unions and school districts, and it's used quite successfully. I also have Sarah Drescher here that will add some further analysis and go deeper into some of these changes. Other changes in the bill is we narrow the scope to apply only to K-12 schools and ESDs. We've removed the provision that required subcontractor profits be provided to the district. It's unclear if profit is required or not in the current law, but in a good faith effort, we are willing to remove the term to keep the law ambiguous. And we also removed the provision that prohibited proceeds from selling or replacing long-term assets in the cost analysis.
Okay. Before we continue, I see that Katie Koba is here, and she was going to be giving a presentation, and I was hoping that we were going to have enough time. You're welcome to stay, and maybe we can get it started, but we'll probably have to carry over for next week, and I just wanted to let Madeline and you know that. Okay, great. So why don't we move on to Sarah, and welcome back.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I did testify previously, and I've submitted written testimony. I don't plan to repeat that. So in the interest of time, let me tell you, I am an attorney with Tedesco Law Group. We're a labor law firm. We represent labor unions across Oregon. Our public education clients include the Oregon School Employees Association, the American Federation of Teachers, the United Academics at the University of Oregon, among others. There are two things that I want to touch on that are found in the Dash 3 Amendment, and the first is that arbitration process. Last time I testified, I told you that I took the only case in Oregon that has challenged a school district's cost analysis, and it was the Central Point School District's cost analysis. And to say it was settled ignores the fact that it went up to the Court of Appeals, and that the Court of Appeals in Oregon issued a decision that is public record that says that the school district did not comply with the cost analysis provisions before outsourcing their transportation services. Full stop. The Oregon Supreme Court refused to review that decision. And that is the law. That is a court decision. Now, the case was ultimately, after that decision was issued, sent back to the Jackson County Circuit Court to determine what happens next. And it was at that point the case was settled. And I can tell you at that point, all of the buses were sold. All of the bus drivers were laid off. And it is my firm belief that the sheer 4.5-year delay of that court process prevented us from achieving the justice that those bus drivers deserved. And so the Dash 3 Amendment creates an arbitration process. It is fast, it is efficient, it is cost-effective, it is not $10,000 to $14,000 per arbitration. I do several of them a month. I have one with the Oregon School Boards Association this month. I have one with the Hungerford Law Firm. Those are the two big firms that represent school districts in Oregon. And I can tell you that arbitration is the process that is used widely, it is accepted, and we use it all the time. And the reason we do that is because it is cost-effective. You do not need to pay an attorney. A representative can handle it. In fact, the arbitration with OSBA this month has a representative, not attorney. No legal fees to that school district. The only cost involved is to the arbitrator, who typically charges $1,200 a day for the hearing, and it is split equally between the parties. That decision by the arbitrator is final and binding. There is no appeal. You get a fast decision. You get a cost-effective decision. It can be scheduled in a day, and I know because I do this on nearly a daily basis. You request a list from the Oregon Employment Relations Board, you strike names on the list to select an arbitrator, you email the arbitrator with dates, and you select a date. It can be done in one day. It is fast, it is cost efficient, and we can get a decision before all those buses are sold and before all of those bus drivers are laid off. Now, will it cause delay? Yes. But shouldn't that be the public policy of the state? When we are looking at outsourcing jobs, and when we are looking at whether there's a true cost savings to this state, we should be having a careful and considered decision. It should not be a rushed decision. Now, there is a cry that there will be students stranded on street corners. I heard it last time. And the truth is that if you look at the Dash 3 amendments, there is an exception. If there is a compelling governmental interest or an emergency, the school district can still proceed with the procurement. So we will not have students stranded on the corners. Will this prevent outsourcing? The answer is no. Because think about what the arbitrator does. The arbitrator either rules that the district complied with the cost analysis, in which case the district proceeds with the procurement, or the arbitrator says that the district failed to comply with the cost analysis, in which case the school district can revise their cost analysis. They just simply make the corrections, they get to try again. So this idea that we're preventing outsourcing is incorrect. We are ensuring that the districts are complying with the law. And the reason we are doing that and the reason we are focusing on school districts is because of the testimony that was submitted by Professor Gordon Lafer to this committee at the last session of the, on this bill, which is in the written record, where he studied and analyzed at the Labor Education Research Center outsourcing of transportation in Oregon and found in his research that the burden was simply shifted from local taxpayers to state taxpayers. And I encourage you to read that. So that's why we're focusing. We have proven data that this is not good, ultimately, for cost savings in Oregon. Maybe the local school districts see it, but the taxpayers in Oregon certainly don't. Let me finally address the change of sole to primary. Currently, a school district is prevented from outsourcing its services if the sole reason that outsourcing is cheaper is because of reductions in employee wages and benefits. Unfortunately, the use of the word sole has allowed school districts to outsource transportation services if they save all of the money from slashes in wages and employee benefits, except for a single cent. If you can save a single cent on a single tire, the sole cost savings don't come from reductions in employee wages and benefits. So this has allowed school districts really to abuse the law and sidestep it by finding a minuscule saving in some other miscellaneous costs, even though the bulk of the savings come from cuts to employee wages and benefits. The entire purpose of this original law was to ensure that if we are outsourcing public services, we are doing so because there are efficiencies that a private corporation has that the state doesn't have. It was not so that we could slash employee wages and benefits. So the Dash 3 amendments would prevent this abuse of the law by changing the word sole to primary, so that a district is now prevented from outsourcing if the primary reason outsourcing is cheaper is because of reductions in employee wages and benefits. And the Oregon Court of Appeals has already defined the word primary to mean the first in rank of importance the chief, the principal, or the most important. As a result, with this change in the Dash 3 amendments, a school district could not outsource if the first most important reason, the chief principal primary reason, is because of reductions in employee wages and benefits. That achieves the original goal of this law, which was to ensure that we're not outsourcing at the expense of family wage jobs. I urge you to support this bill. It is only to ensure compliance with the law. It is not to stop outsourcing. And I'm open to any questions you may have. Thank you for allowing me to testify.
Okay. Let's go ahead and have Stephanie talk. Go ahead and give your testimony, please.
Thank you. Senator Taylor, committee, I'd like to thank you for giving me the opportunity to come up and testify. I am Stephanie Hicks, formerly employed with Central Point School District. I was a bus driver. I was unfortunately laid off at the time they decided to outsource the jobs to First Student. I also was the plaintiff in the civil case that came against Central Point School District, and I successfully was challenged the school district and the cost analysis to the Oregon Appellate Court. So I'm just going to give you a little background of where it all started from. I started my school bus career in 1994 working for the Medford School District. I worked there for 2 years. After 2 years, I decided to go to Central Point School District because that's where my kids were in school. My kids started school in Central Point School District, and they graduated from Central Point School District. I worked for Central Point School District for almost 15 years. I was laid off on June 30th, 2011. While working for this school district, I made just over $15 an hour. I had health insurance that covered my entire family. I also had retirement through the PERS program in the state of Oregon. By the time the district contracted out its transportation services to First Student, I was one of the most senior drivers there. My experience provided me with the opportunity to take some of the most challenging routes they had, whether that was with terrain, weather conditions, or student behavioral problems. I was the driver that they called for. They'd take me off my normal route to cover a vacant route, or they'd pull me from my regular route to cover a trip that was all suddenly going over to Klamath Falls, and all suddenly we got dumped on snow. I had excellent evaluations every year. Some of my evaluations indicated that as a well-diversified driver, able to manage all weather conditions and terrains. Stephanie has exceptional student management skills. Stephanie is a valuable asset to the transportation department. I never envisioned not having a career working with kids and students. I loved my job. I loved working for the school district. I wasn't one of those employees that went to work just to get a paycheck. I went to work because I loved my job. Excuse me?
It's okay. It's okay. Get your
balls. The kids on the school bus were not students. They became my kids.
It's okay. I know it's very hard. We're not that scary, I promise. We'll try to.
It's just filled with emotion because, like I said, those kids weren't just students. Those kids became my kids. And I can tell you that every high school kid would fight to get on my bus to go up the Gold Hill. I can tell you that 90% of the kids had my private cell phone number because if they needed me for any reason, I was there. And I'm sorry, this was very emotional. I didn't want to break down today.
That's okay. We can also take a break.
That's fine. We're going to get through this.
Okay. So maybe we could go ahead and... Okay, go ahead.
Okay. I'll pull it together right here. Losing that job that I loved was very devastating, as you can tell. It took me 2 years to be able to drive down the highway that the school bus is located on. It brought me severe pain. It brought me extreme anxiety. I never, ever had an anxiety attack until this happened. And just watching a bus drive down the road or hearing the backup beeper in my neighborhood, it just brought nightmares to me. I loved that job. I loved my kids. It took me 2 years to finally get over that. 6 it took me a long time to find another job. I actually had to leave Jackson County in order to find a job. I applied for other school districts. Had 20 years of driving a school bus. Who's not going to hire me as a school bus driver? I had to finally go up to Jackson County, or excuse me, Douglas County. And I landed a job with the detention center up there. And I liked it. I was working with kids again. It was fantastic, except for it was on call.
Okay.
It's 90 miles from my home. So I talked to my husband. I said, I really want this. I want to get back in this. So he encouraged me. He supported me, and he stayed by my side. I moved to Douglas County.
Maybe we can move a little further along. Okay. Thank you.
I did move to Douglas County, and I stayed up there for 6 months by myself in an RV. That didn't work out. I couldn't be away from my family. I couldn't be on call. So I came back. I found a job working at Lowe's. Worked there, $9.32 an hour. No health insurance, no retirement. The process that it took to get where we got was 4.5 years. 4.5 years of constant struggling. I cannot speak how the district fared when it outsourced its transportation services, and I can't speak for how the other drivers. I can only speak for myself about after losing the job that I love so much and my inability to find comparable work that paid a living wage and provided affordable benefits. That was the strongest and hardest thing that I had to come over. Although the Oregon Court of Appeals eventually determined that the district had not complied with their cost analysis, it still took them 4.5 years. 4.5 years is too long for anybody to have to struggle to get an answer. It is my sincere hope that no one else has to go through the financial struggles I faced during that time. I firmly believe that if we have the process of challenging a cost analysis was fast-tracked and the challenges was resolved sooner, my struggle could have been lessened. I also believe that if the legislation creates a fast and cost-efficient resolution process, the struggle for those that come after me won't be as hard.
Thank you. Sorry, you did a great. Are you okay?
Yeah. I am.
You did a great job. It's hard. It's hard to come and testify. It's very hard. And thank you so much for coming all the way to Salem.
Thank you for giving me that time.
Oh yes, no, of course, absolutely. We're glad that you came. Thank you.
Thank you.
Jared, do you want to? Someone hand him a microphone. Why don't you wrap us all up here, Jared?
Chair Taylor, members of the committee, Jared Mason Gear, representing the Oregon Education Association. I testified at some length in support of this bill back during when the fire alarm was pulled. Sorry, Satinspiel accused me of pulling the fire alarm. I will state for the record that it was not.
You were actually in the room. I think you were in the room. Yeah. You were in the hall.
So we continue to support the bill with the -3 amendments. I will just, I had testified at some length that, about the professionalism and I think demonstrably superior service that represented employees and employees that are employees of the school district provide to the school district and to those students. I will also just reiterate some of the points about the efficacy and efficiency of the arbitration process. That's something that's used widely between all of our locals and the school districts they work with. I think that's an improvement to the bill that should finally get this bill, after a number of conversations, lengthy conversations, to a place where it's ready to move. And so we urge this committee to move the bill now with the -3 amendments. Thank you.
Welcome back, Senator Knope. Do we have any questions? Okay, well, thank you very much. I appreciate you coming and giving your testimony. So we're gonna close the public hearing on Senate Bill 294. And I feel terrible. We're scheduled to have an informational meeting on the future of the state workforce.
and I was hoping we could get started on it. I don't know that it makes a tremendous amount of sense to do that at this point unless folks want to stay for 5-10 minutes and get it going, or we can hold it over for next week.
I think it deserves more attention than what we can give it to.
Yeah, exactly. I agree. So I apologize. I was trying to give you an out to leave earlier, but so we'll have you. We're going to hold it over from Monday. If that changes, then we'll be in contact. And thank you so much. And we look forward to your presentation. So we're going to hold that over. I'm not sure that I need to have a motion for that, do I? I don't think so. A motion to hold it over till Monday?
Nope.
I don't think so for informational. And our next meeting is on Monday, April 10th, and we're going to adjourn the meeting in the Senate Committee on Workforce. Okay. That hearing is not-